Bien, mesdames, messieurs, chers amis, chers collègues, I wasn't initially expected to chair this final session of the conference dedicated to Michele Tarrufo, but I accept with pleasure this duty. It's the way for me to pay tribute to our friend. Primero, es claramente el homenaje a un gran jurista pluridisciplinar, mundialmente conocido en los ámbitos del derecho procesal, del derecho comparado y de la teoría jurídica. It's not easy at all to be a multidisciplinary jurist. Jurists are not fine with that, you know. So you see, you easily imagine that it is an impossible challenge to be a worldwide multidisciplinary jurist. Michele Tarrufo successfully took up the challenge with disconcerting talent. I am deeply jealous. Pero, en segundo lugar, eso es también el homenaje de la Asociación Internacional de Derecho Procesal a uno de sus gloriosos miembros, quien es también uno de sus vicepresidentes. Michele es un fiel amigo de la asociación, un especialista sin igual de los keynote speeches de nuestros congresos, con su manera única de plantear un problema y de desconstruir un tema. Este tipo de pensamiento crítico no es una cosa extendida en la tribu muy conformista de los juristas dogmáticos. C'est du grand art. Bravo l'artiste. Molte grazie, Michele, per la tua singolarità. Las dos ponencias de esta última sesión van a ilustrar particularmente dos aspectos mayores de la obra de Michele Tarrufo. El primero, con la exposición de Ronald J. Allen on the perils of comparative law research. Everyone here knows the fantastic involvement of Michele in the drafting of the transnational principles and rules of civil procedure, which illustrate so well the perils of applied comparative law research in the procedural field. El segundo, con la ponencia de Susan Ack on justice, truth, and proof, not so simple after all. It will be, I guess, a kind of dialogue with Michele Tarrufo on the basis of his masterpiece, La Semplice Verità. Afterwards, this dialogue will be open to the floor. I'm particularly happy to give you the floor, dear colleague.
Thank you very much, in particular to Jordi, for inviting me to this conference. I had to fly from a very remote area of China to come here, but there was very few things that would keep me from coming here to express my deepest admiration for Michele. Now, one of the problems, though, is going last in the last panel of a two-day conference, it stretches your creativity to come up with new ways to express your admiration for Michele, because it's been done in so many different ways in so many different languages. So I'm afraid I'm going to be rather boring and just repeat things that people have said before. Like, I admire Michele's warmth and graciousness and consider myself very fortunate to be his friend. I admire his intellect, which is razor sharp and piercing, and I admire his industriousness. He publishes at such a rate, it's hard to keep up. Indeed, we held a conference recently at Northwestern on the foundations of the field of evidence and their implications for developing countries. A little shamelessly, we publicized this conference as the most impressive collection of evidence scholars from across the world
ever assembled, including leading scholars from 6 of the 7 continents. It wasn't all that hard to put such an impressive group together, because by inviting Michele, we had one of the leading scholars in evidence in at least 3 continents all by himself. So, and maybe he's had the same impact in Australia, Africa, and Asia as he has had in Europe and South and North America. The reason he is invited is not to these conferences all over the world is not because he is so warm and gracious, but it's precisely because of the quality of his work. When I was preparing these remarks, I noticed again I was going to be scheduled at the end of the last 2 days, and I assumed many of the previous speakers would go into various aspects of your work, and I decided to limit myself to 2 more obscure areas that I thought wouldn't be covered, only to find that one of them already has. I was going to explain your very intelligent, very piercing deconstruction of the work of Kevin Claremont and Emily Sharon, but Steve Burbank has already done that, and I would just say that this paper demonstrates all your intellectual virtues. A keen and supple analytical mind coupled with an encyclopedic knowledge of European legal systems, and you demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that when one knows not of what one speaks, this is, of course, my 2 American colleagues, one should remain silent. This does, however, introduce a theme which I'll return to, which is that comparative law scholarship often suffers from this kind of debilitating lack of knowledge of one or other of the legal systems being compared. And in addition, I have to say it, this will be my one and the only criticism of Michele, but I get ahead of my story. The next part is more about the astonishing depth and breadth of Michele's knowledge. The second thing I was going to focus on to demonstrate my admiration has not been discussed, and I don't think, although I do not speak Portuguese, Italian, or Spanish, so maybe it has, for all I know, but I don't think so. That is a paper on comparative evidence law that's in an encyclopedia. For more than a decade, I've been working on the reform of the legal system with the governments of China and Tanzania. These projects are complicated, and they sprawl over evidence and procedure and rule of law issues generally. In the early years of these projects, we had to research the historical, cultural, social, political history, and anthropologies of these societies, and of course, we also had to canvass comparative evidence law. We thus got to a publication, Michele's, that I doubt is well known to others in this room, but in certain respects should have pride of place in his corpus, and that is Chapter 7, you talk about a mundane title. The mundanity of the title hides the brilliance of what lies behind it. But it is Chapter 7, Evidence, in Volume 16 of the International Encyclopedia of Comparative Law. Now, one doesn't normally think of entries in encyclopedias competing for the best scholarship award, but this entry is nothing short of remarkable. And just to establish that I'm telling you the truth, I say this even though he doesn't cite me very much in this encyclopedia. I mean, even the greatest works of art have their little blemishes, Michele. This is not an entry in an encyclopedia. It's a book-length treatment. It would be over 300 pages if published as a book, of both foundational field issues in the field of evidence, including what has been commented on, his fluency in modern epistemological thinking in particular, nature of truth, knowledge, the implications of incentives, as well as incredibly detailed and rich descriptions of the accommodation of such matters in the procedural systems of various countries. I could do justice to it only by reading it, which you'll be happy to hear. I'm not going to read 300 pages of evidentiary regulation right now. Indeed, I will address what the title of this presentation suggests, that there are difficulties in comparative law research. I think Michele's work might be the best. I'm not a comparativist, so I'm not really in a position to judge that, but I, for various reasons, had to engage comparative work. And collectively, a quite impressive body of knowledge has been created about differing procedural systems, especially in the Western democracies. Had everyone just stopped at the point of rich descriptions, my talk would now be at an end. But fortunately for me, if not for you, late on a Saturday night, just about everyone, more or less including Michele, goes beyond the descriptions to speculating first about the convergence of various systems, in particular two abstractions known as the continental and Anglo-American systems, or inquisitorial adversarial models, and second to actually comparing different systems to leading to assertions about what does what better or worse. Now, thankfully, and this is why I said Michele more or less does these two things, he doesn't do the first. And I think this is because, as Steve Burbank pointed out, he early saw that, just to use a quote, every definition of the attorney's role in civil proceedings, which is obtained by way of mere production from abstract models, is wrong. And I think that's exactly right. However, he has gotten himself entangled in the second of my concerns about the field of comparative law, which is yielding to the temptation of following descriptions with comparisons to the effect that this system is better at doing this, and that system is better at doing that, or this system pursues this goal, or that system pursues that goal. One can see this phenomenon in his critique of Claremont and Sherwin when he ends the paper with a collection of the rhetorical objections to the proposition that the U.S. legal system pursues truth effectively. Now, my recommendation, I'm not a comparativist, so I probably shouldn't be giving you gratuitous advice, but my recommendation is that comparative jurists should just quit this process altogether. Why? For very simple reasons. Useful contrastive comparisons cannot be done by law professors using the standard analytical tools in their repertory. My evidence from this comes from two different sources, and the first is my research team's efforts to be useful in the ongoing evolution of the legal system in China and Tanzania, and the second is from observing the spectacle of law professors trying to do the impossible. Law and society are just inextricably intertwined. One cannot even know what a rule of evidence or procedure means, and certainly not what a code signifies, without doing precisely what I described above as researching the historical, cultural, social, and political history and anthropology of these societies. Then and only then might one begin to think about comparing and contrasting legal systems, but that in turn would have to be done within that complex cultural mix. Now, Michele knows this, but like other people, other scholars in this field, they nonetheless march into this interactive and dynamic thicket, apparently secure in the belief that analysis trumps all. You can read the text, the statutes, and so on, and make global pronouncements. My favorite, and the one I'm going to focus on, being that the Anglo-American system is not at all concerned with truth, and I'm talking, by the way, in civil cases. Criminal cases, we can talk about criminal cases. They present different problems, but I'm talking about civil cases. Whereas that's the all-consuming goal in continental systems. And this comes from very distinguished people in the United States, like John Langbein, who trumpeted the German advantage in civil procedure, Miriam Damaska, who always informs us that the truth-defeating nature of the adversary system, emphasizing in particular the thicket of exclusionary rules that dominate American practice. I don't know if either of these gentlemen have had an impact in Europe, but Europeans join the fun, including my good friend Michele, who has asserted that the stronger party in the United States wins. And truth is such an irrelevancy that the American adversarial system is the least oriented towards discovering it. He informed the Chinese in Beijing in 2013 that the judge, quote, is a passive umpire. The winner will be the stronger and the smarter of the fighters, no matter whether he is right or wrong. And he continues, the most coherent theorization of the American adversarial system says that the search for truth is of no interest to anyone, and therefore it should be avoided as a waste of time, money, and of judicial activities. Most startling, even the Soviet system is comparatively better at truth than finding the trials in the United States. Can you imagine how this sounds to American ears? Even the Soviets, for crying out loud? Now, remember that this claim is comparative. The claim is not that the stronger party, that is the person with more financial, social, or intellectual resources, has an advantage. They do everywhere in the world. The issue is whether it's one system exacerbates, makes worse that comparative advantage that people have. Now, as I say, especially saying we're worse than the Soviets is a very hard blow. But note, and this is the critical point that I'm making, the subtle shift in the epistemological foundations when the descriptions transmute from statutory schemes to their effects in the real world. Claims about the real world need empirical validation and not just analytical speculation. This is the debilitating flaw in Damaska's last book, where he failed to realize that he was crossing the line from analytical utility to empirical truth. And the tools needed to fashion empirically true statements range beyond those normally possessed by a law professor reading books in his office. John Langbein's German advantage nonsense was so uninformed by empirical observation that he was unaware that he was comparing what he would call small claims courts in Germany to complex litigation in the United States. Indeed, this entire line of thought is inspired by the work of idiosyncratic people from bygone eras, the primary source being an American critic by the name of Roscoe Pound, writing over a century ago in the shadow of the equally iconoclastic Jeremy Bentham. That alone should put the researcher on notice that something other than an unimpeachable empirical methodology is involved, and that perhaps a little more work is in order. These empirical failures go to the heart of the standard comparative law effort. The two most commonly asserted causes of inefficiencies and truth-defeating consequences in U.S. courts are the exclusionary rules, complex exclusionary rules, such as actually Larry Loudon talked about today, hearsay and character, and American-style discovery. Now, let me be clear. There is, and with all due respect, the fact that I'm going to disagree with my good friend, Larry, to be sure, there's much to criticize about the American approach to regulating hearsay and character evidence, but just about the least of the concerns is the typically articulated one that they result in the exclusion of relevant evidence. Quite the contrary, when you actually understand them and understand American litigation practice, they are largely rules of admission, masquerading, to be sure, as rules of exclusion. Now, take the hearsay rule. The hearsay rule excludes all assertions made out of court if offered in court to prove the truth of the matter asserted. And if this were taken seriously, this would create a huge exclusion of what is often quite reliable evidence. But look, no system can operate that way. Almost all your knowledge is based on hearsay. Who your parents are, what day you were born, where you live. If you're an expert, most of your expertise comes from reading books. We live in a world of hearsay, and it should be obvious from the very beginning that no system can operate with the systematic exclusion of what we all take for granted and what is essential for our lives. And as it turns out, this huge area of potential exclusion, what I put up on the screen, is decimated by definitional exemption and exceptions, leaving only a small area of exclusion of the most rank and unreliable hearsay, the admissibility of which would be irrelevant because it would be ignored by any rational person. So just look what happens. These are just some of the hearsay exceptions and exemptions, and I'm just going to explain. These are the rules, federal rules of evidence. I'm going to explain what some of they are just briefly. The first by far, and this takes a chunk out of the exclusion, i.e. makes admissible, is rule 801D2. What this rule does is it makes admissible against the person, against, not in his favor, he can't concoct evidence, every single statement the person ever made in his entire life, in any form whatsoever. And in addition, in any hierarchical system, any statement a person makes in that hierarchical system is admissible against not only himself, but anybody above him in a supervisory capacity, like, for example, in a corporation. Now, that is a huge chunk out of what would otherwise be admissible hearsay that comes in. There's more. 803.1 and 2 makes admissible any statement a person makes observing something or immediately thereafter or when they're under the influence of a startling event. I don't want to spend all day lecturing about hearsay, so let me just go through these quickly. 801.3 and 4 makes admissible all statements that pertain to the interior of the body, physical, mental, emotional statements, and anything made to a doctor for purposes of either diagnosis or treatment. Maybe you're unaware of 803.6. It's called the business records exception. Every single record kept by a business in the ordinary course of business and where it's the ordinary course of business to keep that record is admissible over the hearsay objection. So that makes all the records of corporations, institutions of any kind admissible, not excludable. Now, you can see what's happening here. 803.8. A hugely important exception, not much discussed in the comparative law literature. Every single public record is admissible over a hearsay objection, even if it contains opinions. So conclusions, diagnoses are admissible, not excludable. You can see what's going on. There are a whole series of other exceptions that make just about anything you would think possibly reliable admissible. Statements in old documents, statements in Bible, statements in family records. 804 then adds a whole series of things where even more is made admissible if but only if the party is unavailable. All these others, by the way, are independent of the availability of the party, so they come of the witness, so it comes in. And then, in sort of the coup de grace, to use my only foreign language phrase that I know, there's a rule 807 that says if none of these other hearsay exceptions work, make one up. Yeah, make one up. If you have reliable evidence and they don't fit, doesn't fit within this, make one up. So ironically, of those who actually understand the hearsay rule and how it operates, the only one complaining about the restrictive hearsay rule are people not well trained in the American legal system, Europeans, and a legal historian at Yale. When Americans complain about the hearsay rule, at least in civil cases, it's invariably because of the breadth of inclusion, not its truth-defeating exclusions. The most recent example, Judge Posner, who's the most famous non-Supreme Court judge in America, was quoted yesterday. We all like to quote Richard Posner. Just a couple weeks ago, handed down an opinion, a long concurrence, where he was complaining about the hearsay rule because it forced the judge to admit too much evidence. Now, I think this is bizarre beyond belief. I mean, why he would bother to do this? What difference does it make if you admit too much evidence? I mean, just go ahead and admit it, consider it, and be done with it. But nonetheless, that's the complaint you get about the American hearsay rule. Not that it's too restrictive, but it's too accommodating. I'm not going to bore you with character evidence, but it's the same phenomenon. See, what's happening in both these cases, character evidence and hearsay, is a promise of exclusion is made. That's true. If you read just part of the rules of evidence, you see hearsay is excluded. You read the character evidence rules, character is excluded. But then what happens is that promise is not redeemed. It's almost completely destroyed in the context of hearsay. In the context of character evidence, it's the same thing. You start with this promise of exclusion, then all these examples over here, I'm not going to go through it. I will if somebody wants to talk about it later on. But even the character in a criminal case comes in any situation which it matters. When does it matter? When he takes the stand. If he takes the stand, he can be cross-examined about just about anything in his background. The judge may say to the jury, if there is one, you can only take this into account for credibility purposes, but, you know, who can make that distinction? And if you don't take the stand, you do not get acquitted. So, you know, for reasons, again, I could go into. So you have to take the stand, and if you take the stand, even the thing that Larry was complaining about earlier, the character of the defendant comes in. Now, so this is, I would just go through the same thing, but this is boring at this point. All this talk about the American exclusionary rules, in short, is simply wrong. Although, again, asking one to see that point, who doesn't know the American practice, might be asking too much. These areas of evidentiary regulation are criticizable, but not because of the exclusionary effect, but because of their peculiar regulatory form. And that's true. However, and this is a very important point, the law of evidence, when I say the law of evidence, when I make any claim, I'm talking about the American situation, unless it's clear to the contrary. The law of evidence serves many different purposes in addition to just determining admissibility. It allocates power and discretion, structures relationships between participants as well as branches of government, and serves social needs. A detailed set of rules keeps power in whoever writes that rule. Discretionary rules give power to whoever is exercising discretion. So there's a lot of things going on in the rules of evidence beyond admission and exclusion. To criticize, indeed to even understand the American evidentiary practice requires engaging at all these levels, as I am sure is true of regulatory measures in your countries as well. And this seems to be lost in the standard comparative law critique about the truth determining functions of the American criminal trial. Now, it seems to me, and I emphasize the word verb seems, that this debate is curious from the other side of the spectrum as well. While emphasizing the commitment to truth-seeking, comparative lawyers brush aside the fact that this can only occur if you have access to evidence, and you probably know better than I do that you do not make access to evidence very readily available. The German Federal Supreme Court has gone so far as to say that a party is under no obligation to make available to the opponent for his victory the material which is not available to him. I will only say that how the truth can emerge without access to evidence is a puzzle. Whatever the cost of discovery, it has the benefit of moving disputes toward accurate outcomes. Its absence obviously makes true outcomes considerably unlikely in all those cases where the person's unfortunate enough not to have the evidence that he needs. Now, it could be that the price of discovery comes too high in the United States, and that's true. I mean, you can get to perverse results because of not allowing something like discovery or whatever, or because the price is too high, and I'll return to that in just a second. And that's the complaint that's made about discovery in the United States by, again, comparatives, this cost is too high. But it's not just discovery. I discovered many years ago in my disagreement with John Langbein, and I was apparently the first one to bring this to the surface, that you have enormously sprawling privileges. I mean, I have two pages here of descriptions of German privileges that include everybody who has an interest in the outcome, essentially, or who is in a relationship to somebody who has an interest in the outcome, and as well as all the professional privileges. Now, I did a brief review of European countries. Again, I'm not a comparativist. There's a lot like that going on elsewhere. A person from Netherlands describes the privileges in the Netherlands as breathtaking in scope. Well, in any event, it's not just, and I'm going to move on to a new topic, and I want to kind of get to one last interesting point and then wrap up. It's not just the shaky empirical foundations of the claims that adversarial systems are indifferent to truth and the curious neglect of the truth-defeating rules of many European systems that should put a researcher on notice that perhaps something is amiss. So should simple common sense. How could a modern economy in an advanced state function if the legal system did not guarantee a high probability of factually accurate outcomes? Without accurate outcomes, without accurate resolution of disputes, rights and obligations are meaningless. Consider the simple case of ownership of a property. You say you have the right to possess, consume, and dispose of something. I say, give it to me, it's mine. How are we going to resolve that? You're going to find a fact finder, and you're going to present evidence that the world was a certain way at a certain time in which you were given, found, or made, or bought that item, and because of those facts, you have the right to possess, consume, and dispose of it. The critical point is that rights and obligations are dependent upon the facts and are derivative of them, and this cannot be overstated. This ties rights and obligations to true states of the world and anchors them in things that can be known, which is what actually allowed the Western civilizations to flourish as they have. Now, if the results of litigation were driven by something other than accurate reconstruction of facts, modern commerce would come to a halt. It's the promise of accurate dispute resolution that stops people from breaking the law and from breaking their promises. I will not sign a contract unless I expect to adhere to its terms. I know if I don't, I will bear the consequences because I am sued. If I'm sued, the legal system normally gets the facts right. Now, let me be clear about something. I'm different from everybody, most of the people in the room, for another reason. I don't speak any language other than English. That already makes me strange. But I'm also not a normativist. I don't do normative work. I'm a scientist. I'm not a philosopher. I do positive work. I'm trying to understand how legal systems operate. So what I would say in a situation like this is, if you think something's true, you make a prediction based on what you think is true, and then you try to confirm or disconfirm that prediction. So if rights and obligations are dependent on efficient and accurate fact-finding, we are in a position to make certain empirical predictions. That the countries with more efficient and accurate fact-finding will tend to have stronger economies and be more innovative. The underlying intuition is straightforward. Things like fraud, conspiracies and restraint of trade, embezzlement, insider trading would tend to thrive in inefficient and ineffective legal systems. And they tend to be done by individuals and institutions with resources. So if the system faces the double whammy, the double hit of favoring the stronger party and returning inaccurate verdicts, fraud and the like will proliferate. These are all anti-competitive practices that reduce total social welfare. They also would obviously suppress innovation. If large institutions with capacity to exploit patents can do so with no fear of consequences, they will do so, which would lower the expected return to the innovator and suppress the underlying innovative activity. The obvious prediction is that there will be a correlation between economic growth and innovation and efficient and effective legal systems. I obtained the data on economic growth since 1980 on five major European economies and the United States, and I also threw in the UK for good measure. Why 1980? I wanted a long period, because the one thing that's stable throughout that period is the legal system, so other differences would wash out. I picked 1980 because it's 2 years after an economic downturn that gave 2 years for the differing jolt of the 78 recession to work through the system, so you have a reasonable baseline. So we could do other dates as well, but here's what you see. You see that with the exception of Spain, and that's interesting, I didn't want to suppress the data when I saw Spain. With the exception of Spain, the United States, this is relative growth per year. The United States economic growth is about 20% faster than all the economic countries per year than is Spain. Why is Spain different? It turns out, well, from 1975 to 1980, Spain was in the depression caused from, what was his name, the dictator?
Franco,
the post-Franco period. So you're starting from basis zero. And you know, starting from basis zero, economic growth is pretty easy. Now, so this is economic growth. What data on innovation is consistent with economic growth? These are patents issued by the U.S. Patent Office. I went to 1977 just because the data was there. I should have stayed with 1980, but it would have been hard to sort that out. Patents issued by the U.S. Patent Office, over half of them are for the U.S. and the rest of the world, about half. Now, there are other patent offices in the world, including the European Patent Office. It issues only about 20% of the patents that are issued by the U.S. Patent Office. But even in the European Patent Office, the U.S. originating patents are the largest set in all patents of all patents issued. Now, what other measures of innovation might there be? Well, how about Nobel Prizes? Now, I left the top line off. These are the Nobel Prizes in chemistry, physics, and medicine. And these are surrogates for innovation. So here, Germany by far has the most Nobel Prizes in these three fields, and I put Germany up there, and here's the US. Nobel Prizes in these fields. Now, these data are not comforting for those who espouse the random inefficiency of the American legal system, although there are many variables that affect both economic success and innovation. Perhaps Americans are so industrious and creative that they can surmount the pitfalls of their legal system so that the sporting theory of justice references should be taken as compliments to the character of the nation rather than criticisms of its legal system. Maybe the answer lies in the substantive law. Maybe you have lousy substantive law that suppresses innovation and economic growth. If you want to make that argument, great, but that I would give me some pause if that were true. Or maybe you think that I'm missing a slide. Maybe you think that this is something I'll come back to in just a second, that the legal system has no effect on primary behavior. Do you think that? If you think that, then why do you care about the legal system? Conferences like this are kind of a pointless waste of time. Now, I don't think these data are dispositive. I want to be clear, I'm not a comparativist. I don't think these data are dispositive of who has a better legal system. Were I in the business of comparing legal systems, I'm not. I'd want considerably more data, and there's stuff that you can imagine, such as prorogation agreements among large multinational entities to see where people vote with their feet, so to speak. I looked briefly for it. It's not obviously available. Arbitration agreements are, and they tend to be, they have forum selection clauses that put New York, London, Geneva, and now recently Singapore as the locations. So I'm not trying to establish the superiority of the U.S. legal system. I'm trying to complain about an absence of empirical validation in comparative law research. And even if the American legal system is more efficient and effective, there are other social values that condition the ruthless pursuit of truth, and this is especially true in criminal cases. My only point is that to make progress on these deeper questions, and I want to just go back to these last slides, just take me about 1 minute, Mr. Moderator, then I'm done. It requires serious engagement with the actual operation of legal system, which is an empirical, not an analytical exercise for the most part. And this, the comparative law field has, in my opinion, so far as I can tell, yet to do effectively. Now, at a higher level of generality, and as my citations to economic growth and surrogates for innovation suggest, in my opinion, there's a deeper difficulty with standard academic work. Comparing legal systems for their own sake is a very curious enterprise, as is analyzing some discrete development that may benefit or hurt one class of interest or another, which is standard US academic fare, not just comparative. The concern of the legal system should be overall social welfare, not just errors in the legal system, but the interaction of legal and primary behavior. But what does conventional analysis do? It looks at errors at trial, like we talked about today. But errors at trial are only one set of errors. There's errors of settlement, where settlement it makes mistakes for different reasons. And then there are all the cases that aren't settled, and they're not settled for reasons influenced by the legal system. The legal analyst should be taking these things into account, in my humble opinion. But it's more than that. Who really cares about all that? That's litigation behavior. Why optimize litigation behavior? What you're trying to optimize is the relationship between litigation behavior, correct decisions matter too, and primary behavior. That's the underlying significant goal, to optimize the sum of litigation and primary behavior, unless, again, you think your legal system has no effect on primary behavior. Now, the failure to grasp and operationalize this point is a serious constraint on the utility of much of American legal scholarship. Now, I'm shifting from comparative law scholarship to American legal scholarship, and I have insufficient knowledge of any other country's literature to comment. Grappling with overall social welfare is not an easy task, as I can tell you from personal experience and personal failure in trying to do so. Nonetheless, I want to come back in my final comment to Michele. To move on to that task, to go on to the task that I'm criticizing some for not having done, for our own country for not doing it effectively, requires the careful sorting out of analytical work, because this is the foundation of the empirical questions that you ask that Michele has done so masterfully. It's a necessary foundation for moving on to the deeper and more difficult questions, but it needs to be work that is done with empirically, to be empirically informed, not just regarding one's favorite system, but about any about which one comments. So to end where I began, even those who view themselves as empiricists, as I do, we are in the debt of you, Michele, for creating the analytical foundation that is the necessary step for asking the next questions. But please, will you stop quoting Roscoe Pound? Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, dear colleague, for this very dynamic, eloquent, and illustrative presentation.
We change.
Okay.
And we have to change the show.
The show.
It must go on. I'm probably incompetent to do this.
Here, let me see. Is the PowerPoint on the home screen? This is mine.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where the PowerPoint is located? I don't want to.
No, we don't want to mess anything up.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. might make the building explode or something.
Yep.
Could you send my folder along?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I grabbed it by mistake. Sorry.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Well, dear colleague, you have the floor.
Thank you. Buenas tardes. Quiero empezar agradeciéndole a Jordi Ferrer por su amable invitación y explicando por qué esta conferencia en esto Tarufo Fest. ¿Por qué esta? Fue escrita después un congreso en Medellín en octubre del año pasado. Después mi conferencia, Michele me dice, estoy enteramente de acuerdo.
Yay. Pero después su conferencia, yo estaba pensando, no sé en qué grado. Yo estoy de acuerdo contigo. Entonces, vamos a ver. Vamos a ver. Okay. I guess this is... No?
Just push the down button.
The what button?
This down button.
The down button. Okay. Start with two quotations. These rules should be so construed as to administer every proceeding fairly, eliminate unjustifiable expense and delay, and promote the development of evidence law to the end of ascertaining the truth and securing a just determination. Federal Rule of Evidence 103, purpose, the pre-restyling version. I just prefer the English in the older one. This is from a novel by Steve Martini, who reminds me of someone. Now, who could it be? Okay. Most victories in criminal courts are fashioned by the preponderance of perjury. You spin yours, and they spin theirs, and in the end, the side that is most adept at invention wins. Throughout history, truth has withered and died of loneliness in most courtrooms. This is Harry Hines, who is the cynical partner of the main character in these novels. Bentham writes of injustice and her handmaid, falsehood, and the metaphor rings true to me. Because however good the laws are, however just the administration of those laws, if someone is found guilty of a crime he didn't commit or liable for an injury he didn't cause, or of course, vice versa, a substantive injustice has been done. That's why truth matters. If substantive justice is to be possible, therefore, there must be such a thing as factual truth, which is not just a matter of what anyone believes or everyone believes, and we must be able to figure out what the truth of disputed matters of fact is, which in turn requires that there be objective standards of better and worse evidence that are not pure convention, but really do indicate likely truth. If these presuppositions weren't true, I think legal proof procedures would really be a kind of horrible judicial theatre, a kind of cruel farce. Of course, even if they are true, specific legal procedures need to be competent to reach factually correct verdicts often enough. But that's impossible unless these presuppositions are true. So, part one of this talk defends those five presuppositions. Part two explores the competence of the US evidentiary procedures to this end and comments much more briefly on civil law procedures. Tengo demasiado por una media hora. Nobody told me. Tienes una media hora solamente. Peirce writes, you certainly opine that there is such a thing as truth. Otherwise, reason and thought without a purpose would be without a purpose. And what truth means, he goes on, is that something is so, whether you or I or anyone thinks it is so or not. Everyone believes this, he says, or he would not ask any question. And neither, I would add, would he make any assertion. Because even to assert that there's no such thing as truth is to commit yourself to its being true that there's no such thing as truth, and so to undermine your own claim. So why do so many philosophers believe, or at least profess to, that truth is illusory or relative or subjective or partial or unattainable or something? Well, I think some are overreacting to the view of others who think that truth is almost holy. You know, truth grows a capital T and we all bow. Others confuse what passes for truth with what is true. And some, I think, are misled by an ambiguity in absolute between certain and not relative. Sure, some all truths are uncertain, but that doesn't mean any truth is relative. And some of confusing truths, some of which really are relative, with truth, the phenomenon, two different things. Some misled by expressions like true for me, true for you, when in fact, if we disagree about whether P, then unless P is ambiguous, one of us must be right. and the other one must be wrong. Some are confused by the fact that some truths, including legal ones, are made true by things people do. But this doesn't mean they can't be discovered, and neither does it mean they're not objective. They're made by what people do, but they are nevertheless discoverable and objective. Dealing with all these bad arguments, it's a nightmare, and it would leave us with nothing constructive, so I'm not going to chop off 10 of the Hydra's heads. Some think it's enough to say truth is correspondence to the facts. In Popper's case, that's Searle on the left and Popper on the right, invoking the sacred name of St. Alfred Tarski. This only complicates matters, and it doesn't help anybody. Why? It misconstrues Tarski's T-schema, which is not his theory of truth. It's a material adequacy condition on any theory of truth, and which he explicitly denies, and with good reason, can be generalized to produce such a theory. It forgets that Tarski always insisted my theory applies only to formal languages, not to natural languages, and explicitly criticizes correspondence theories, which he says, I can't understand, sorry, I'm a simple soul, I'm a simple mathematician, I don't know what you're talking about. Moreover, logical atomist versions of the theory, as in Russell and Wittgenstein, bring many problems. So does Austin's conventionalist version. And Searle's version is simply correspondence with no teeth. It has no content. Fact is just a generic word for whatever makes a true statement true. Correspondence is just a generic word for whatever relation is involved. And as he says, my theory is just a small bunch of tautologies. Well, yeah. And that's not very helpful. Better bet, I think, is start with Aristotle's to say of what is that it is, or of what is not that it is true, etc. And Frank Lowndes' articulation of this insight, I call it laconicism. A proposition is true, Ramsey says, just in case it's the proposition that P and P. For example, it's true that Smith is either a liar or a fool, just in case Smith is either a liar or a fool and not otherwise. Obvious, right? As Ramsey says, there is no platitude so obvious that eminent philosophers have not denied it. In fact, it's a way of becoming eminent to deny it. Virtues of this theory are it applies regardless of subject matter, it requires no reference to society, community, individual, paradigm, etc. So it's not relative, it's not subjective, and it accommodates the intuition that whether a proposition is true depends on whether things are as it says they are. It's true, for example, that there was a visible stop sign at the scene of the accident, just in case there was a visible stop sign at the scene of the accident. It's true that his swine flu vaccination caused Mr. Cook's Guillain-Barré syndrome, just in case that vaccination did cause his GBS and so on. Phew, we're 25% done. Richard Rorty, oh God, tells us not only that he has no use for the notion of objective truth, but also that he sees rationality as nothing more than civility, respect for the opinions of those around one. Excuse me while I throw up. You can't acknowledge that claims are often made on flimsy evidence without ipso facto acknowledging an objective difference between better evidence and worse, between the weak, the flimsy, and the partial, and the stronger, the more robust, and the more comprehensive. As Bentham says, questions of evidence are continually presenting themselves to every human being every day and almost every waking hour, indeed. And no doubt weighing evidence was something Rorty did every day, too, when he picked a flight, when he decided on a medical treatment, or checked whether he'd received his enormous royalties from his publisher. The practice of judging evidence is also the professional business of certain people. Navigators, surveyors, experts on the authenticity of artworks, scientists, historians, physicians, detectives, and, yes, lawyers judges, jurors. The theoretical articulation of what makes evidence better or worse, what makes a claim more or less warranted, is the professional business of epistemology, which is, I'm afraid, for my sins, my professional business. And it's needed because our intuitive grasp of these matters, though serviceable, is imperfect. Although, as Mill said, without that intuitive grasp, we couldn't begin to build a theory. That's correct. I'm not saying those standards are objective. I'm saying only what William James said when he said, there is a sentiment of rationality. There is a sense of, okay, our doubts are satisfied. This is a subjective feeling, but it's a mark of the reasonable. It's not what the reasonable is, it's a sign of the reasonable, a fallible sign. A decent theoretical account ought to help us understand why we sometimes misjudge evidence, spell out what makes the evidence with respect to a claim better or worse, what makes a belief more or less justified, a claim more or less warranted. Earlier, I contrasted weak, flimsy, partial evidence with strong, robust, comprehensive evidence. This form of words just came naturally, but not coincidentally, it exactly parallels my account of the structure of evidence. I call it Fountierentist. Quality of evidence depends on how supportive it is with respect to the claim in question, how secure it is independently of that claim, and how comprehensive it is, that's to say, how much of the relevant evidence it includes. All this needs spelling out. Ugh, I hate to tell you how long I've spent spelling this out. The connection, for example, between supportiveness and explanatory integration. The difference between positive, negative, and irrelevant evidence and its consequences for independent security. Complicated. I got it wrong before I got it right. And very important, the material character of relevance. You can't know what's relevant to what without knowing things about the world. Is the way this person writes his G relevant to whether or not he could be trusted with the petty cash? Well, it depends whether the graphology is true. Okay. Even in this sketchy form, though, it suggests how we can misjudge evidence, allowing our wishes or fears to distract or skew our attention, making us lazy or selective. So we look only to supportiveness or only to independent security or etc. I'm not trying to give a list of rules for evaluating evidence. As far as I can tell, those are usually operationally idle in any case. Nor am I trying to tell you how to justify a claim to an audience. That's not epistemology, that's rhetoric. I have nothing to tell you that you don't know already. Nor is it to offer a categorical account of justified, warranted, or reasonable. On the contrary, it's about degrees of proof. That's what I have a theory of, degrees of warrant, as in the various levels of proof that we identify in the law. Whew, halfway there. What can be said about the competence of the proof procedures of common law systems to arrive at factually correct verdicts? Or about the competence of civil law procedures? Well, the first thing I want to say is that contrast is a gross oversimplification. Everything's sort of mixed. There are grades of difference, not a categorical one. Sometimes it's said, I guess I've been reading some of the same people as Ron, common law procedures are manifestly epistemologically inadequate, civil law procedures are obviously better. I disagree. Not because I think common law procedures are obviously better, but because I think the issues are so complicated that any simple comparative judgment will be wrong. So I'm not going to make one. That said, I'm going to consider three familiar arguments why common law procedures are epistemologically bad. The system isn't focused on the discovery of truth, but on resolving disputes. The adversarial method is a poor way to reach the truth. Exclusionary rules pull against the desideratum of comprehensiveness. I think these are all three bad arguments, vitiated by misunderstandings of what the system really is. First rests on a false dichotomy. Either a legal system must aim to resolve disputes, or else it must aim to discover the truth. No. What the US legal system aims to do is to resolve disputes in a substantially just way. Aims to do. I'm not yet saying it succeeds at this. Does that mean resolve disputes and discover the truth? No, that's not exactly what it means. But to understand that, you have to see what's wrong with the second argument. No question, a common law trial is utterly different from a scientific investigation or historical research or even the investigations of a detective. Quite different. So if it were a search for truth, the way it goes about it would be highly inefficient, to say the least. But as the Supreme Court said in Tehan in 1966, the basic purpose of a trial is to determine the truth, which by my lights means arriving at a conclusion about the facts in a legally correct way, which is not the same thing as seeking the truth, let alone as discovering it. It's something else. What the common law fact finder is asked to do, as I understand it, is not whether Smith murdered Robinson, but whether the proposition that Smith murdered Robinson has been established to the required degree of proof by the evidence presented. That's an epistemological task, I notice. As vividly illustrated by the 2011 Florida trial and acquittal of Casey Anthony, young woman accused of murdering her small daughter. I think everybody in Florida thought she did it, including the jurors. But the case the prosecution put on was just disgracefully weak. The jury acquitted correctly. It did its job. It did precisely what it was asked to do. I regret to say, subsequently, they received death threats from the public for having done their job. So, as I understand it, the rationale is not, as Peirce believed, hot and partisan debate is the way to investigate. What bullshit, he said. Well, yeah. Now, that is bullshit. But the rationale is that even though no one involved in a trial is directly seeking the truth, their zealously pursuing their own ends will often enough result in the truth coming out. This is kind of like the invisible hand theory of markets. I don't know if you can read in the back what those sock puppets are saying to each other. Sock puppet one is saying to sock puppet two, I believe there's an unseen hand behind everything we do. Indeed. The idea is a trial is one stage of a whole long process. Before the trial, the police will have investigated, maybe forensic scientists will be at work and so on. Prosecution and defense will have marshaled their evidence, anticipated what the other side will produce. And at trial, each side will try to make the strongest case they can, reveal weaknesses in the other side. The judge will ensure the rules are followed. The jury will determine whether the party with the burden of proof has met the standard. And I think the rationale is, given the inevitable restraints of time and resources, this is a reasonable way of arriving often enough at factually correct verdicts. All that's high, abstract theory, and some more follows. Third argument, exclusionary rules inevitably hinder the emergence of truth. Well, some rules are, as sometimes said, contra-epistemological, without a doubt. You know, evidence of subsequent repair is inadmissible. For example, spousal privilege. Okay. You should read Bentham on spousal privilege. Gives every man a license to commit any kind of wickedness with the assistance of his wife. They really do hinder epistemologically. So by my lights, they are only justified if the other values they protect outweigh hindering the emergence of truth. Other exclusionary rules, however, are intended to foster the emergence of truth. The rule against hearsay and, of course, all the many exceptions. The rule requiring expert evidence to be reliable. The thought being, if we had all the time and all the resources in the world, best thing would be, hear all the evidence, thrash it out. But we don't have all the time and all the resources. So it's better not to waste time with what will probably be misleading or probably be unreliable. However, there's always a however. None of this shows, none of this theoretical guff shows that any common law system specific rules are conducive to the goal of factually true verdicts, let alone that as those rules operate in practice, they do this as well as we would hope they do, which I think there's ample reason to doubt the US regime does. For example, does Federal Rule 702, as interpreted by the Supreme Court in the Daubert trilogy, really enable courts effectively to weed out unreliable expert testimony? What can I say? You wish, but I'm not convinced. Do all those exceptions to the hearsay rule really identify reliable forms of hearsay or not? Some of them, we know, are historically based in cases where it's not clear the court didn't have the evidence completely wrong in the first place. And it's far from obvious that the answers to all such questions would be unqualifiedly affirmative. I love that sign. What fool thought of that? Moreover, the invisible hand rationale, which is the best I can come up with for this system, seems to require roughly equal resources on both sides, which is rarely the case. And of course, a strongly adversarial culture can encourage attorneys to use the very skills that would enable them to flush out the truth to more dubious ends, like spinning or concealing inconvenient evidence, which of course is precisely what Mr. Hines was complaining about. Civil discovery rules intended to improve the scrutiny of evidence are sometimes misused, and of course they're restricted by proportionality, so that they don't actually do as much towards flushing out the truth as one might have thought. And when you look at the system as a whole, I'm sorry if some of this has been said already, but how was I to know it would have been? There are many ways our system avoids going to trial. Heavy reliance on plea bargaining, which preempts the thrashing out of evidence. While I was writing this paper, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about drug trials in Miami. The average time spent on a drug trial in Miami courts, these are misdemeanor trials, 3 minutes per defendant. All of them plea bargained, of course. And how, well, I wonder, does the average attorney predict what the result would be at trial? The attorney for the dog is saying, before we agree to a plea bargain, my client wants to know, are we talking dog years or man years? Settlement in civil cases, of course, also preempts the thrashing out process and can also hinder epistemologically. And sometimes, you know, we just can't know. We can't know which company made the diethyl stilbestro that this plaintiff's mother took 20 years ago, which has now caused damage to her daughter. We can't know. There is no way to recover that information. Or no way to know which of several exposures in various workplaces to asbestos caused this particular plaintiff's mesothelioma. There is no threshold dose, so there's no way to know. And it's no wonder, then, it sometimes seems as if the system is moving towards purely pragmatic dispute resolution, governed by cost considerations, as if it was just too expensive and too hard to bother figuring out the truth. As you can tell by my tone, I regard this development with some unease, to say the least. We're almost there. An old proverb says, there are more ways of killing a cat than drowning it in butter. Okay. There are more ways of trying to arrive at just determinations than the American way. I think it's like the several routes from my house to the airport, each of which has advantages and each of which has disadvantages. Neither the common law nor civil law procedures strike me as inherently ill-suited to flashing out the truth. Not like trial by ordeal, which I think was just absolutely hopeless from the beginning, because I don't believe the theological presuppositions which underpinned it. And which does better is an enormously complex question, which depends not on abstract considerations of the kind I have been trafficking in for a while, but all those nitty-gritty details about how the particular system actually works in practice. But I'm going to stick my neck out this far, waiting to be chopped off. I doubt a civil law trial looks much like scientific work or historical research or the work of an auto mechanic trying to track down the source of a knocking sound any more than a common law trial does. I think it probably looks quite as different, though in a different way. And therefore, I also assume that like a common law trial, a civil law trial is subject to real constraints of time and resources. Can't take forever, it can't cost the entire gross national product. And it doesn't continue indefinitely, waiting for more evidence to come in, which is precisely how the sciences work. We won't decide until we have enough evidence. And except perhaps in France, but you will illuminate me about what conviction intime really means, it's subject to standards of proof. So I take it the task of a civil law judge isn't entirely unlike the task of a common law judge, a common law jury. Does the evidence measure up to the standard? Okay. Measuring up, the only image I could find was measuring up for the trousers. So, even though they go about it in a different way, and in a certain sense, I would say, civil law trials go about it less obliquely than common law trials. Which is more effective? Well, in congresses, in Colombia, in Brazil, et cetera, et cetera, I frequently hear people say, look, a civil law judge has to write an evaluation of the evidence, whereas a jury doesn't have to say anything about how they reached this verdict. I scratch my head and I think, is that discipline, write an evaluation, more or less than that imposed by a juror's having to discuss the decision and the evidence with the other jurors? I have no idea. And even if I did, this would only be a tiny part of the whole story before you could begin to say, this is more effective, that is less effective. Another old proverb says, the devil is in the details. The devil's just shown up at this judge's podium and is saying, I'm here about the details. Give me the details. I got my first glimpse of just how many and how various the relevant details might be while I was writing this paper. When I read an opinion piece in the newspaper with the title, Mexico's Rule of Law Crisis. What did it say? It urged that the remaining states hasten to adopt the 2008 reforms, moving to a more adversarial system. As I read more, well, the first thing I did was go to the international law librarian and say, look, I just read this. My hair is standing on end. Please tell me whether this person is off the wall or is telling me something that's based in fact. And I learned enough, at least, to know it was based in fact. I also learned, as I read more, that Chile had made precisely such a shift between 2000 and 2005, but supposedly this was smoother because of the influence in Chile of the German system, itself more adversarial than the Spanish system on which Mexican law was based. You can imagine, you know, I've got a week to finish the paper, and I suddenly uncover this enormous heap of information, which, oh my God. Thinking of what would be involved in trying to compare the epistemological efficiency of, say, the Chilean and the German systems, or for that matter, the US and the Canadian, let alone civil law versus common law, I began to think a fuse was about to go in my brain. Something was going psh, 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 psh. I really thought my head was about to explode. So I decided to let Shakespeare's Constable Dogberry, in a comedy of errors, have the last word. Constable Dogberry is given to malapropisms, if I might say, anachronistically. Constable Dogberry says, "Comparisons are odorous." What he means is comparisons are odious. Without all those details, comparisons are indeed odorous. 101% done. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias, estimada colega, por su presentación. Your talks were both very stimulating. I think it's the best way to favor and open the debate. We have 20 minutes to do so. Michele?
Well, I'll try not to quote Roscoe Pound any time more, although the temptation is very strong, at least for one reason, and that is that I have an interest for the history of legal and non-legal theories, and I know very well that Pound wrote about the American system more or less one century ago, from 1906 and so on. But I'll try to do that. I'm not sure about that. Another point is about the problems and the dangers of comparative law. I am skeptical enough about comparative law, although I consider myself a comparativist. But I am skeptical enough because I know how many bad how much bad comparative law is done in the area of civil procedure as well as in many other areas of the law. But one thing is comparative law is a difficult enterprise. Has dangers. Abstract comparison is nonsense. One has to take into consideration all the factors conditioning how a legal system of procedure works. Well, okay, history, culture, institutions, political factors, needs to be, all needs to be taken into consideration. But let's pay attention not to push all this too far. Because if we do that, we conclude simply that comparative law is impossible. And as a comparativist, I cannot share this conclusion, because I am accustomed to believe, as many comparativists do, that one of the best ways to know your own legal system is to look at it from the outside. And looking at it from the outside means to compare your system with the other systems, which is not the problem of saying civil law is better or not better than common law. This is thinking that way is stupid, and although I am very critical considering the American adversarial system, I'm not saying that the civil law procedural systems are better. I know a lot of bad civil law procedural systems, but this is only to stress the fact that they are different. Now, from the point of view, the less general one, from the point of view of the search of truth, we can analyze different systems in order to say this is more truth-oriented and this is less truth-oriented. Because if I am considering a system, as the Italian one, for instance, in which we still have rules of legal proof, and we compare this aspect of the system with other systems, as the American one, that don't have legal of rules of legal proof, when I am authorized to say that the Italian system, from this point of view, is less truth-oriented than another system. Because if we don't work that way, simply as I said before, we should conclude that comparing legal systems is stupid and leads to nowhere, which is not. Because in the experience of the good legal comparison, we learn a lot about other legal systems, as I learn a lot as a comparativist about my own Italian legal system. And, well, I could argue about the globalization, about many things that would be in favor of the good comparative analysis, also from the point of view of the search of truth. But very well, I don't want to open here what I would like very much. It is a long seminar about the American procedural system. So I have to spend just a few minutes about that. One thing is that although Ron doesn't agree with that, there is a rather important literature about the negative aspects of the American procedure. Recently in this conference in Colombia, I heard my old friend Linda Mullenix saying that notwithstanding the federal rules of 38 and the federal rules of evidence of 75, actually, she said, there is no search of truth in the American civil procedure. Well, one says yes, one says no, I don't know, but the only thing I'm stressing is that there are no certainties about this. And more specifically about what I consider the core of Ron's argument, that is saying very, very roughly that the economic efficiency and the innovative capacity of the United States should be taken as an evidence of the fact that kind of procedure is oriented to the search of accurate truth about the facts in issue. I don't see this connection, very simply, because I could say that the economic efficiency of a system is possible even when the system doesn't care of the truth in the decision of cases. It's possible. It's perfectly possible. Therefore, well, I don't discuss the data about the American economy and the Nobel Prizes and so on. I simply say this says nothing about the special capacity of the American adversarial system to discover the truth about the facts in issue. It is an important point, but I don't say it. I repeat, a system may be economically efficient, and there is no doubt about the economical efficiency of the American system, but this doesn't say anything about the search of truth in that procedural system. An argument in favor of that, as Susan stressed that before, well, how many times a criminal or a civil case in the United States arrives at the trial phase and therefore is decided with a final decision about the facts? 10% in criminal, maybe less. I don't have a statistics about the settlement, pre-trial settlement.
It's 1% in federal cases, civil cases.
Okay. 1%. Well, every time, my argument is this, every time that a case doesn't reach the trial, there's nothing to do about truth. At most, there is something to do about the prevision of what could be a verdict about the case, but this may determine the parties more or less to reach a plea of guilty in criminal or a settlement in civil. But my question is this, a system in which in 1% of the case they decide about the fact, what about truth? Can we still say that it is a system oriented to the search of truth? I say no, simply. In the paper of Larry Loudon, there are statistics about the criminal, and the average percent is 10% of criminal cases. So about what are we talking? Are we sure that in such a situation that these are statistics and not theoretical speculations? These are facts. In a system like this, we can say that this is a system oriented to an accurate determination of the truth of the facts. I may have some doubts about this kind of evaluation. I agree that the normal comparison, so to say, about common law and civil law, when made in very general terms, says nothing. But this does not prohibit to make comparisons, provided that the comparison among systems is made in a correct way. I shut up with a word about Ron's theory that I appreciate very much, but since I read him and his theory, if I am not completely mistaken, Ron wrote several times about the decision of cases, and he says that he is describing how American judges decide and choose among possible alternatives. And his theory is that the criterion, the rule for choosing, is the relative plausibility of the different stories about the facts of the case. But my suspect is that relative plausibility has nothing to do with truth. It's a different standard of choice, if I intend it correctly. Maybe I'm wrong. But one story may be more plausible than another story. The plaintiff's story may be more plausible than the defendant's story, even when it's false. Because plausibility of a story is something that has to do with the narrative coherence of the story, with the logic of the argument, and so on. Maybe I'm wrong in interpreting this theory, and I'll study it more. But if I am not completely wrong in interpreting the theory of Ron Allen, he is not working with the search of truth. His theory is different. The American judge assesses the relative plausibility of a story, which is not to say that the judge establishes which of the stories is true. Thank you.
Is this on, or
how do I make it come on?
There we go. Well, thank you, Michele, for those responses. There's really an interesting gap between the work that I'm doing and the work that other people are doing. I don't care about normative issues at all. I'm not trying to explain how judges decide cases. If I could get access to that, I guess it would be interesting. I am trying to describe how the system actually operates. But having said that, I'm just mystified by some things. You say, for example, you can imagine an economic system that works efficiently without a legal system. Now, in my world, I would say, okay, well, let's test that. The fact that I can imagine something, I can make up something, doesn't mean it actually could be true. And when you look at the world at large, that proposition is simply disconfirmed. In every country that has had dictatorships without rule of law, you have poverty, every single one, right from beginning to end. Now, this though shows the gap that is here, the difference between just analysis and just empiricism. And I'm on the empirical side of that gap. The point about trials. I'm not talking about the rules of evidence at trial. I'm talking about the rules of evidence. The rules of evidence operate not just at trials. They operate to affect primary behavior as well, and they affect the cases that are selected for trial. It's a much more plausible reason to think that the reason so many cases settle in the United States is because people know what the outcomes are going to be, because they know what the rules of evidence are, and they know that the facts are going to be found accurately. That seems to me a more plausible explanation than anything else. Just last, because I don't want to, I want other people to talk and so on, but on this relative plausibility, this maps onto what Susan's talking about. You can't pursue truth in trials like science pursues truth. In fact, you wouldn't want to. Science pursues what it can pursue, can take all the time it needs, and if it doesn't have to decide, it doesn't have to decide. That's not the situation we find ourselves in. The issue we find ourselves in is how do you decide given the constraints that are put upon you, and the idea of relative plausibility is, in fact, there's likely to be a relationship between truth and the story that can be told. Now, you can say, I can imagine one that isn't, where there isn't one. Well, that's true. You can imagine it. But the issue isn't imagination. The issue is empirical reality. Do you really think that evidence of the way things were doesn't tend to exist? And do you really think that evidence of the way things were is not going to be what makes a story plausible? Of course it is.
Thank you. Please.
Okay, very briefly. I'm a little clearer to what extent we agree. I would not for a moment say comparative law is impossible. My point was, you can't do it without all the details. And it takes a lifetime to grasp the details of one system, two systems. And I thought Mexico and Chile were going to kill me because I only had a week to try to get some grip on what was going on. And what it taught me was what you need to know is just enormously complex to make any such comparison. I do want to take you, I want just to be a little obstinate about the question about truth orientation. Okay. I noticed that you sort of changed the language, began to talk about truth orientation. I actually think that's a rather slippery expression. I was trying to distinguish between thinking of a trial as a search for truth, which I think is a mistake, and thinking of the trial as part of a process in the course of which you hope, given these rules, this system, this setup, the truth will emerge. These are different things, but it doesn't mean truth has nothing to do with it, that we're dealing with the second kind of thing and not the first. And I think the concept of truth orientation kind of fudges over exactly what I was trying to distinguish. So I'm protesting a little about that vocabulary.
Thank you. Please.
Close the computer perplexes people's vision.
Yes, and mine.
But it protects us from having anybody throw things at us. Like, you want to throw a book at me right now.
Please.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for your excellent presentations. And my comments are the following for Susan. By saying, I was wondering if not by saying that the legal system's goal is truth determination rather than truth search or truth seeking, you are not subscribing to a certain version of legal formalism. And if that is so, maybe we should abandon our intuition that we want law in terms of general rules to be applied to facts, because according to this new version of legal formalism, the law applies to people for whom the system has been able to gather evidence, and that evidence is sufficient enough to meet the criteria of a standard of proof. So that this leads, I think, leads you to say that we don't want murderers in jail, but people for whom a murder can be proved. That we're not as a society prepared to say that. And for Ron, even though you say that you are not interested in normative theory, I think that you are making a normative assumption, but maybe I'm wrong on and that assumption may be that legal systems' stability should promote or should influence primary behavior. How? By promoting economic growth and by promoting an increase in innovation figures. I wonder if you are not considering or handling that as a normative assumption. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wasn't intending to subscribe to any kind of ism, including formalism. The thought never crossed my mind. I was simply trying to understand what the difference is between saying that the purpose of a trial is to determine the truth and that the purpose of the trial is to discover the truth. And I think these are importantly different, and that determine is in some deep sense a concept which is inherently legal and can't be understood outside the context of some legal system and some set of procedures. And that confusing that with discovering the truth, which is the kind of thing that a scientist or a detective or a historian might do, simply invites confusion, exactly the kind of confusion I was trying to dispel. So it was basically a tight focus on that concept of determine. Averiguación, see? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Han.
Well, so I have my normative commitments, like we all do. But in my work, I tried to suppress them. That's why I said I was, even though I was making a claim about the innovation and wealth generation of the American economy, which I think is influenced by the legal system, otherwise if you don't think that, it's crazy. But I wasn't making a comparison between the systems. I'm just trying to understand them. And there may be other explanations for things, or maybe other reasons why you want what you want. Now, if you were to ask me, not within my work, but outside my work, do I want to live in a system that furthers economic efficiency, economic growth, and innovation? The answer is yes. I want to know what the costs are, and I want to know, try to figure out where I want to constrain that, because other values matter. But yes, I do. But that's not the point of this. The point is that these kinds of empirical questions are what lie at the heart of the shift from making analytical statements about things to making empirical statements about things. And that's a huge gap, and it's being missed. It's being missed not only in comparative law research, it's being missed in the United States generally. I mean, this is a critique I would make of American legal scholarship generally.
Thank you. Thank you. ¿Quién quiere la palabra? Another question from the floor? No?
They're exhausted.
Exhausted. I think you are all exhausted after this wonderful conference. Tenemos que terminar ahora. Me parece esta conferencia fantástica dedicada a Michele Tarufo. Tu sais, cher Michel, qu'il y a en français une expression qui dit « à tout seigneur, tout honneur ». Tu es un seigneur. Il te revient donc l'honneur de conclure cette conférence organisée en ton hommage.
A mí me parece claro que un trabajo como lo que todos hemos hecho en estos dos días no puede ser concluido. Es un principio de discusión, de investigación, que yo espero pueda seguir siendo desarrollado. Entonces, yo no puedo decir nada de conclusión sobre de mérito, digamos así. Todos hemos escuchado o recibido cosas de grandísimo interés. Entonces, yo puedo solo decir dos cosas muy sencillas. La primera es que haber sido, digamos así, la causa o el origen de estos dos días de trabajo para mí es un grandísimo honor. Yo he sido la ocasión de todo lo que ha sido dicho aquí. Este es un motivo para mí de grandísima felicidad, no solo de honor. Y la otra cosa son simplemente agradecimientos. Agradecimientos a Jordi Ferrer, que ha sido el jefe de la organización de todo esto, y a su grupo de jóvenes que le ayudaron en todas las tareas, en todos los trabajos que organizar un evento como esto requiere. Un agradecimiento especial a la señora que dirige la biblioteca de la Facultad de Derecho de Girona, que, como Jordi ha dicho, organizó este catálogo de mis escritos, de mis obras, con un trabajo muy importante y muy pesado. Sí, el agradecimiento número dos sobre este punto es a Max Aramburu, que es la sola persona en el mundo que sabe todo lo que yo escribí. Entonces, yo no lo sé, pero Max conoce perfectamente todo esto y sé que trabajó con la directora de la biblioteca. Entonces, agradecimientos también a todos los ponentes, muchos, a todos los amigos que viajaron aquí para hacer ponencias, sino también solo por participar a los trabajos. Y mis felicitaciones por todos los que sobrevivieron a esta prueba, que no ha sido fácil, ¿no? Y last but not least, un agradecimiento a mi esposa, Cristina, que ha soportado en estos años la vida conmigo. Yo creo que no ha sido fácil, no sigue siendo fácil, pero ella la hace con mucha generosidad, con buen espíritu. Entonces, esto es un agradecimiento personal, pero yo quería hacerlo de manera pública y no soltanto de manera privada. Entonces, una vez más, muchísimas gracias a todos y a la próxima.